is, amazingly enough, how it was done. It was no wonder more and more laws were being written to control the use of CRISPR. What could heal could also deform, kill, or exterminate. They had given Rochelle an oral sedative because the anemia constricted her veins and she was terrified of needles. They hadn't meant to put her out, only halfway there, but she fell asleep listening to RG's lengthy explanation of just how, in the near future, when science perfected gene editing in neural cells, the brain itself could be altered. Miranda's careful intravenous insertion of the precious fluid took less than 10 minutes. And that was it. Miranda gave David's arm a squeeze for good luck, removed the IV, and dropped the needle, tube, and bag into a bin for safe disposal. "Let's let her sleep," David said, watching his daughter. "Should wear off soon." He nodded. "Give me a moment with her, will you?" "Of course." Miranda touched his shoulder. "I have a good feeling about this, David. I know it doesn't work on everyone, but she's strong. Have faith." He put his hand on hers. "Thank you. I'll wait here until she wakes up." He stood over Rochelle after they left, reviewing all that had preceded this moment. All the worrying, the endless nights of fear she'd suffered. Such a brave soul. He finally sighed and stroked her cheek, noting that her eyes were moving behind her eyelids. He wasn't a man of prayer, but he prayed in his own way that she was dreaming well. She twitched and let out a faint whisper. His mind drifted to his wife's death. She'd suffered nightmares during the last trimester of her pregnancy. She often woke in a panic, completely disoriented, memories jumbled. In the final week, she'd become convinced that they were all part of an experiment in some elaborate conspiracy. Fearful of what she might do to herself and the baby, David had insisted the attending physicians give her sedatives. She died in her sleep, here, in this hospital. Miranda managed to save baby Rochelle through an emergency C-section, but David had never forgiven himself for his role in her mother's death, regardless of the fact that sedatives had nothing to do with her passing. Or had they? The sound of the door gently closing behind him pulled him from his thoughts. He started to turn, expecting to see Miranda. Instead, he saw a tall man dressed in a white jacket and dark slacks. Shiny leather shoes. Dark hair slicked back with oil. Mouth grinning wide to show a perfectly formed set of two white teeth. His eyes were a light brown, almost amber. Gentle and piercing, inspiring warmth and confidence. A stranger. What was a stranger doing in the hospital? Or in Eden, for that matter? A stranger wearing a single diamond stud in his left ear and two silver chains around his neck. David could smell his cologne at 10 feet. "Hello, David," the man said. "Name's Smith. Vlad Smith. I've come to bring sight to the blind." Smith shifted his gaze to Rochelle and stepped forward. Alarmed, David moved to cut him off. "I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to leave." Smith pulled up and stared at him. "You don't understand, David. The CRISPR you just injected into your daughter isn't going to work. I'm your only hope." He knew about CRISPR? "How did you get in?" "Simon..." "Think of me as the one Simon reports to, although that isn't entirely true. Either way, I'm here to make a few small adjustments. There's something very wrong with this valley, and I'm going to fix it. Your daughter is the key, so I need to fix her first." David stood, speechless. "Are you going to yield to reasoning, or am I going to have to manhandle you?" "Have you lost your mind?" "Oh no, not me, David. But you have. You're as blind as your daughter. The good news is that blindness is merely a matter of bad programming and clogged memories. Smith cocked his left eyebrow. Did you know there's a way to manipulate specific memories now? Erase old ones and overwrite them with new ones using neural lacing? Not my gig, but I can help people think clearly again. Once they see my power, they'll let me do what I need to do. The lives of everyone in Eden depend on it. So please, if you don't mind, step aside. David shoved his finger at the door, heat flushing his face. Get out! Smith stepped up, grabbed his shirt, and threw him against the wall like a rag doll. David's head crashed into the drywall and he dropped to his seat, dazed. He tried to get his feet under him, but they refused to respond in any helpful way. Stop! Smith was already moving, as if in slow motion from David's perspective, bending over Rachelle, pricking her finger with something he'd withdrawn from his jacket. Then David didn't know what he did, because Smith's body blocked his view. Smith shoved the object back into his breast pocket and touched Rachelle's eyes with his thumb and forefinger. "Welcome to the world of the seeing, Pumpkin." Rachelle suddenly sat up, eyes wide, screaming. Startled, David finally clambered to his feet. Vlad Smith turned and walked toward the door. Rachelle's scream faded, but her mouth and eyes were still stretched wide. And then, as if her plug had been pulled from the wall, her eyes and mouth snapped shut, and she collapsed back onto the table. David lurched toward the bed. "Well done, David." Vlad Smith spoke softly behind him. He heard the door opening. "The world as you know it ends in 6 days." David reached the bed, only one thought on his mind, to wake Rachelle from her sleep. He grabbed her arm and shook her. Her head wobbled, but she remained peaceful and oblivious. He shook her harder. "Wake up! Wake up!" She lay dead to the world, which could only mean that she wasn't merely sleeping. Panic pushed reason from his mind. He slapped her face. "Wake up! Wake up! Wake up! Wake up!" But she didn't. He grabbed her wrist to check her pulse, even though he could see that she was still breathing. But checking her pulse wasn't always easy, due to her anemia. He released her wrist, dropped his ear to her chest, and heard her heart beating rapidly. The pounding of feet outside was followed by the door swinging open and crashing into the doorstep. "What happened?" Miranda asked. "I heard a scream and wake up!" David shook Rachelle violently, lost in fear. Miranda shoved him aside and grabbed Rachelle's wrist, instinctively checking for a pulse. "You're hurting her. Tell me what happened."
A man came in and did something."
"Something? What are you talking about?" She snatched a small flashlight from the counter, clicked it on. "What man?" David's mind couldn't find the appropriate words to explain. Miranda opened Rachelle's eyes with one hand and shone the beam into each pupil. "No dilation." She quickly pinched Rachelle's arm, then listened to her heart with a stethoscope. When Miranda straightened, her face had paled.
"What's happening?"
"She's unconscious."
"I can see that. What else?" he demanded. "What's happening?"
"She..." Miranda hesitated. "I think she might be in a coma." Chapter 3. I remember falling asleep on the table, and even in that sleep I could feel the cool liquid flowing up my arm as Miranda administered CRISPR. After that, I can't remember. I can't remember because the deep pain that filled my eyes and slammed into my skull ripped all thoughts from my mind. I was screaming. I do remember that. My world had gone black. I felt dismembered from the reality I had known as Eden, cut off from all dreaming, all thought, all reality. For a beat that lasted both forever and for only a split second, I didn't seem to exist. I was dead to life. In the next moment, I was remembered, meaning I was fully aware of my physical form, but in a different state of consciousness. In a dream, I thought. In every other dream I'd had, I couldn't tell that I was in a dream. This time I could. A lucid dream. I sat up, palms planted on the ground, on the sand. I was in a desert. I twisted and scanned the horizon. Everything was fuzzy, real and clearly recognizable, but not sharply defined. Rolling dunes rose tall behind me and in front of me, boulders and shallow canyons, maybe 100 yards away. Another nightmare. I knew it had to be because my hands were shaking, like I'd just come out of a horrible situation that I couldn't remember. I was wearing filthy, torn pants and a thigh-length blouse, a white cotton tunic that looked as if it had been dipped in dirty water before drying. It was large and slipped off one shoulder. I had dusty bare feet with a cut on my right heel. My lips were dry and chapped, and my throat felt like a gunny sack. And there was something off about my body, something wrong, something... I looked down and saw it immediately. I was more developed. I wasn't mistaken. I was older. Maybe only a few years, but I definitely knew my body well enough to tell the difference. And my skin wasn't pale. I pushed myself to my feet and looked around, feeling dread. My footprints were visible in the sand dune to my right. By the looks of it, I'd lost my way in this desert and collapsed. Movement above caught my attention, and I tilted my head up. Two flying creatures were high in the blue sky. Birds. Huge, fluffy white birds that looked like flying squirrels, only much larger. The creatures descended toward me. I stood frozen on the sand, thinking I should run. But there was no way to outrun them. So I remained still, hoping they would leave me alone after satisfying their curiosity. Instead, they circled once before floating down to the sand not 20 feet from where I stood. I took a step back. With wings folded, they looked more like huge plump bats or Ewoks, 2 feet tall with green eyes. They didn't look menacing, but when had that ever meant anything? I'm not sure I was breathing at this point. One of them, the slightly plumper one, was smiling, then waddling toward me with a pronounced limp. He tripped on a stone and flapped his wings to steady himself, and I saw that part of his right wing was missing. I took another step back, glancing at the other one, the stern one with a fixed face. "Greetings, daughter of Elyon," the plump one said. I blinked. They could talk? "I am Gabel, mighty warrior of Elyon, and the serious one behind me is Mikal, wise one. Not that I'm not wise," he paused. "You can see us?" "Of course she can see you," Mikal said, waddling forward. "Do you think she's just staring at the sand?" "You can't blame me," Gabel said. The creature stared at her for a long moment, then stuck webbed fingers at the end of its wings into its ears. "Can you see what I'm doing now?"
"Please, Gabel."
Gabel turned to his partner and quickly offered his defense.
"Didn't I tell you she could see us?" "Yes, you were right. Now stop with your antics, or you'll frighten her."
He faced me.
"But you see what I'm doing?"
"Yes." He waited for my response, so I finally gave him one. "I'm dreaming," I said.
"Dreaming? Then you didn't see what I did. Can you see all of me, or just a part of me? Like a white patch of fog?" Gabriel.
The other one wobbled forward.
Please don't mind him. He's...
I just want to be sure, Gabriel said.
Can you see?
Half my mind was telling me that talking to a fluffy white bat was impossible. You stuck your fingers in your ears.
Aha! I knew it.
He pumped his wounded wing, fist clenched. I nearly smiled.
We are Roush, Gabriel said, bowing with one wing folded across his plump belly. Servants of Elyon.
Mikal looked up at me in all seriousness, ignoring his comrade.
And you, my dear, who are you?
I'm Rachel.
Rachel?
He glanced at my shoulder.
You're a long way from home, Rachel. How did you get here? And how can you see us?
Gabriel piped in. I looked at my bared shoulder and saw that I was marked by a tattoo. A pencil-thin line forming a black circle maybe 3 inches in diameter. I got here because I'm dreaming, I said. In reality, I'm in a town called Eden, which is in Utah, and that's also why I can see you. This is a dream. They exchanged glances, and I saw concern in their eyes.
Dreaming? Gabriel said. Don't be absurd. To dream, you would need to be asleep, yes? And yet I can see you as clearly as you can see me. And I will tell you without the slightest doubt that you are most definitely awake.
Here I am, but there I'm sleeping on a table in a hospital, and there I'm blind. You're a little blurry, but the fact that I can see you at all is proof enough.
For a long beat, both of them just stared at me. Then you're saying that I, Gabriel, slayer of Shataiki, and celebrated warrior despite several minor setbacks, am only a dream.
He spread his wings wide with all the grandiosity of a mighty ruler.
That I, who can protect the albinos and vanquish Chile with a single swipe of my foot.
And here he executed a rather funny-looking kick.
Do not even exist.
Now I couldn't help but give him a smile, if only a hint of one.
Not like this, Gabriel,
Mikal chided. His eyes held mine.
Please forgive his enthusiasm. He refuses to accept his new limitations. A terrible battle, only last year, you understand? If anything, he's more determined to prove his value.
Do you know Thomas of Hunter?
Gabriel blurted, oblivious to McCall's prodding.
I taught him all he knows. He too once thought he was dreaming.
Mikal snapped his right wing wide to silence his comrade, who settled back with a sheepish grin.
What my friend means to say, Mikal went on, is that you are not the first to dream of the histories. It is well known that Thomas of Hunter also dreamed of them. Although I was under the assumption that gateway was permanently closed, evidently I was misinformed.
What histories?
This place you think you are from. Utah. There is no Utah now. But there once was, over 2,000 years ago. It's written in the books of history. Did you just wake up?
My head spun. No, I'm still sleeping.
I mean here, he said, pointing at the sand. Did you just wake up here?
Here? Yes, but not there. There I'm...
As I said, Utah is only a dream. If you ask the right questions in that dream, you'll see that it is all an illusion. You were dreaming of the histories while you were sleeping here. That is all. Just like Thomas of Hunter once did.
Was it possible? Logically, yes, I suppose. But if so, why couldn't I remember this place? Who's Thomas of Hunter? I asked.
Mikal was taken aback,
Gabil started to lift his wing.
He's the one I taught.
He fell silent and lowered his wing when McCall held his up.
You mean to say that you've never heard of Thomas of Hunter?
No.
But of course you have. The whole world has. Most certainly all albinos, of which you are one. And most certainly all Elianites from the far side, of which you are one.
McCall indicated the tattoo on my right shoulder.
A mystic by your marking. So you see, you have heard of Thomas of Hunter, you just don't remember. What do you remember?
I lifted a hand to my forehead and ran my fingers through my hair, trying to make sense of things.
Nothing about this place, I said, other than waking up on the ground.
The horde must have forced her to eat the poison, Gabil said. How did she get here? Elianites have never crossed the pass to this side of the divide.
McCall waddled to my left, eyes fixed on me with even greater interest now. They were utterly serious. I'd never had a dream remotely similar to this one.
You remember nothing?
Nothing,
I said. Then Gabil is correct. You've been given the poison that erases your memory.
He paced quickly now, fingers on his chin.
In truth, you are from the far side of the Great Divide, where you must return. There, your memory will surely come back to you. What if she's the one?
Gabil asked.
It's not for us to decipher,
McCall said.
What one? I asked.
Never mind,
McCall said.
Now you should also find the rambutan fruit. Consuming it will keep you from dreaming. If you stop dreaming, you won't dream of the histories. You can never trust such dreams. Some are true, but many are...
A gasp from Gabil cut him off. I quickly followed his stare to the dunes. A white horse plunged down the slope, leaving a trail of churned sand that covered my footprints. On this horse was a rider in a white robe that flowed as he leaned into the wind. Both of the Rausch dropped to their knees, heads bowed low, facing the onrushing rider. I stood where I was. Two things kept me from running. First, the Rausch were clearly lovable creatures. I thought I could trust them. They didn't cower, but bowed to honor the visitor. But even more than the Rausch, the very atmosphere seemed to have shifted. A palpable calm settled around me, as if the air itself revered this man. The horse slowed to circle us. I turned with him before he stopped, not 10 feet away. The rider's eyes, like the Rausch's, were green, and looking into them I was transfixed with assurance and wonder. His hair fell to strong, broad shoulders. On his feet, brown boots were laced up to his knees. The man swung off his horse and walked up to me, watching me intently, smiling. He reached for my right hand and placed a kiss on my knuckles. A faint pulse of power rode up my arm, a warm vibration that might have startled me if not for the fact that it seemed entirely natural, like an echo of something I already knew. He dipped his head.
So good to see you, daughter.
I managed a slight nod.
The poison they fed you has distorted your vision, yes? Would you like me to heal your eyes?
I cleared my throat. Can you? He winked at me, then lifted both hands and delicately touched my temples. A flash brighter than any star blinded me, and I recoiled. As quickly as it had come, the light vanished, and with it my old view of the world, replaced by new sight. My view of the man shifted into a clarity so vivid, so sharp, so real, that I snatched my hands to my mouth and gasped. His eyes, only a moment ago green, were now such a bright green and so beautifully formed that I thought they might be a dream within my dream. He was smiling.
Not a dream, my dear. You are merely seeing again the way you were made to do.
I stared at the dunes beyond him, the sky above, the two Rausch still bowing on the sand. I could see every hair of their fur, every feather on their wings, every grain of sand. I'd never seen so clearly in any dream, definitely not when awake.
"It's a beautiful world, isn't it?"
he said. I looked back into his eyes, drawn into the mystery of them. He glanced over my shoulder at the dunes.
"We don't have much time, so I need you to listen carefully. Yes?"
Each word he spoke seemed to reach into me and touch my bones.
"Yes,"
I said. Then again,
"Yes."
"Good."
He lifted his hand and drew my hair from my forehead, like a loving father.
"All men, all women, all humans, yet breathing, live in fear in its many forms, even as they strive to find peace in this life. Though seeing, they do not see, just like you."
My eyes were wide.
"But I can see."
"Can you? My dear, you don't even recognize yourself yet."
"I don't?"
"No. When you do, if you can, the world will change in the blink of an eye."
His words were gentle but true to the core, as if each syllable was a force. A knot filled my throat because he was describing my blindness in Eden, surely.
"It's no mistake that you've been allowed to feel the fear that resides in the hearts of all. Fear both known and unknown. You, dear daughter, have been chosen to show them the way beyond fear in this life. Only when the shadow of death is vanquished can the lion lie down with the lamb."
His words rang so true that I accepted them.
"First, you will bring the world to a point of great crisis," he said. "Then you will show them the way out of fear. Do you understand?"
No. No, I didn't understand. But as he spoke it, I didn't care that I didn't understand. I just took it for the truth.
"Yes,"
I said, voice thin. "But to show them the way, you will need to resolve your own fear. The blind cannot lead the blind. To be set free from your own fears, you must rediscover the five seals of truth before the appointed time. This is your quest now. Time is short. Follow the narrow way that few have found, a way unknown by flesh and blood. The seals will cost you everything, and show you a power far greater than you can possibly imagine. Then you will truly see what is yet unseen."
His words swirled through me and stilled my breathing.
"Only if you succeed in finding the seals before the appointed time will you be able to complete your task and lead all who follow out of the suffering that enslaves. Do you understand?"
"Seals?"
I didn't even know what to ask.
"What are they made of?"
"Truths, not objects. You will see."
"This isn't a dream?"
"No more or less than the other,"
he said, removing his hand.
"The seals are equally powerful in both."
My knees felt weak, and for a moment I thought I might fall. But that wouldn't do. So I stood as firm as I could, considering the implications of his words. He lowered himself to one knee, scooped up some sand, and cupped both hands around the grains, gave it a squeeze, then opened his fingers to show me a round lump of stone the size of a baseball.
"What do you see?"
I almost said sand, but it wasn't that anymore. "A stone."
"A stone. Everything you see with your eyes is like this stone." the world before you, the body you live in, the tasks you face.
He placed the stone in my hand as he said it.
Everything.
I nodded.
Is it heavy?
No.
Who's holding it?
I am, I said.
And who are you?
The question confused me. I stared at my hand, my arm. Who are you? Where are you from? Why are you here? I wasn't sure.
As the questions whispered through my mind, the flesh of my hand and arm faded and became translucent. I could see through my skin, through the veins that ran down my arm. But those veins were not filled with blood. Light, as bright as the sun, ran through my veins. I blinked to clear my sight, but the vision persisted.
That was me?
But more. And then it changed. The light in my veins began to recede up my arm, replaced by dark blood as it withdrew. First at the wrist, then slowly up my forearm. I was so taken by the sight that I didn't at first notice the weight of the stone in my hand. It was growing heavier. By the time blood had replaced the light past my elbow, the stone was unbearably heavy. I almost dropped it, but clung tight, thinking this was a test of some sort, but I didn't have the strength to keep my arm elevated. The massive weight pulled me to one knee and slammed my hand into the ground, overcome by the weight of that one stone. The blood replaced the light up through my shoulder, like a creeping vine slithering through my veins. Then it was into my neck and brain, and darkness swallowed my sight.
Shadow Man's taunting filled my mind. When you see, I will blind you again and again.
I began to panic and was about to scream for help when my vision returned from the top down. I jerked my head to look at my shoulder and saw that the light was filling my veins again, replacing the blood as it moved down my arm once more. And as it did, my arm regained its strength. Stunned, I lifted the stone off the sand as the last of my blood was replaced with light. As I stood, my arm and hand became opaque flesh once more, a normal body.
Whenever you try to hold the stone in flesh and blood, it will overwhelm you, the man said. Instead, look to the light. Don't be afraid of the shadow it creates. Remember who you are. Return to the truth of your origin and recognize yourself. For this, I will send you a helper. Do you understand?
Yes.
But only in part.
He nodded.
Find the 5 seals for yourself, 49th. When you do, you will know your origin, and you will recognize yourself. What happens to you will happen to all. You cannot lead the world out of darkness until you find the 5 seals for yourself.
I was the 49th. It's what Shadow Man called me. But if Shadow Man was darkness, the man before me was light. I blinked, filled with questions. He took the stone from my hand, and I watched as it turned to sand and slipped through his fingers and fell to the ground.
Who are you?
I asked, looking back into his green eyes. I am known by many names, he said with a whimsical wink. But you can call me Justin.
Justin? Just Justin?
It is enough.
And I knew it was. He looked over my head, to the dunes again.
They're here.
I twisted to see for myself.
Who?
I saw who, and caught my breath. At least 50 mounted warriors lined the dunes' crest. I could see their black leather armor, the swords strapped to the saddles, their long dreadlocks. An odor reached me, carried down by a light breeze, the stench of something rotting. The Rausch streaked for the sky. I spun back, flooded with the familiar fear of my nightmares. Who are... But Justin, too, was gone. Just gone. I was alone again. No, not alone. I twisted back and saw the first of the horses plunging down the dune. Terror crashed through my chest. They were coming for me. My survival instincts swallowed me whole. I sprinted breakneck toward the only refuge I could see. Chapter 4. David paced in the examination room, mind lost on the madness of all that had transpired in the last 2 hours. Nothing made sense to him. There had to be an explanation, a way to figure out what had happened. And once he made sense of that much, he'd be able to take steps to reverse it. His mind was caught in a loop, rehearsing the events as they unfolded. They'd injected CRISPR, and Rachelle showed no adverse reactions at first. Then Smith arrived like a puppet master, speaking in riddles. He'd evidently pricked her finger. Nothing else that they could determine. Rachelle lay on the bed, breathing evenly. No sign of trauma, no indication of any nightmare. Miranda had taken all her vitals and started a simple saline IV to keep her hydrated. Other than being in a coma, there were no indications she had suffered any harm. He took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
Easy, David. It's going to be fine.
The door banged open and Miranda walked in.
Just got off the phone with Dr. Bouchard in Paris. Lucky to get through. Not much is getting across the Atlantic. It's a mess out there, and I don't think it's going to get any...
What did he say?
He ran a test on the sample of the CRISPR they sent. Its coding is correct. They've never seen a reaction like this without tying it directly to the errors in the genetic coding. Neither have the Chinese, as far as he knows.
What if Rachelle's different? Is there any chance a reaction like this could be traced back to CRISPR?
He doesn't think so. They have her blood work. You just have to give her time. Look at her.
Rachelle lay in peace. Miranda walked up to the bed and adjusted the blanket.
I really think...
She froze.
What's this?
What?
David stepped around her and looked at Rachelle's right shoulder. A black circle, roughly 3 inches in diameter, had been etched into her skin.
How did that get there?
I don't remember it earlier.
She drew her thumb over the skin.
I could swear it wasn't here an hour ago. Looks like one of those temporary tattoos.
Odd. As odd as Smith's sudden appearance.
Miranda pulled the blanket up around Rachelle's neck. Truth be told, we're not even sure she is in a coma. If she hasn't woken up by morning...
Morning? No.
He shoved a finger at the wall.
The world's falling apart out there. We have no idea what communications and transportation will be like tomorrow. If I'm going to take her to Salt Lake, I have to go today.
She stared at him.
You know that's impossible.
I know that my daughter is in crisis.
Rule number one in Eden. Approved visitors and deliveries entered regularly, but Simon Moses permitted no member of the community to leave the valley unless their departure was to be permanent. No one ever had taken that option. Voluntary retention was one of Simon's greatest bragging rights. Miranda rested her elbow in the crook of her arm and nervously bit at her fingernail.
You do realize that even if you get out, you can't discuss CRISPR with anyone outside of Eden. What we did isn't exactly legal.
I realize that. They don't have to know about CRISPR. You're saying her condition has nothing to do with it anyway.
David headed for the door.
Keep an eye on her, and call me if anything changes.
Where are you going?
He turned back.
Simon has to know. If nothing changes in the next hour, I'm taking her to Salt Lake.
It would take him 5 minutes at a jog to reach the administration offices. Attached to the north side of the church, the building was made of stone blocks, fortified with enough steel to withstand a nuclear blast. Of course, if it ever actually came to that, the only people to survive would be those hunkered down in this building, and the supplies in the basement would eventually run out. There would be no surviving any nuclear blast, and they all knew that. But it made a fine statement, and to say that Eden was prepared for any event short of a nuclear blast wasn't an understatement. David and his wife, Rochelle, had been approved for residency by council vote 17 years earlier. After seeing the idyllic setting, Rochelle insisted that Eden was the perfect place to raise a child. "Even small towns need good therapists," she said. She'd been right. David had grown to love the town, even more after his wife's death. He took the back way, in no mood to meet whoever was out and about. By the looks of it, business had resumed after the morning news rush. Cindy leaned against the wall at the entrance to Bill's Hardware, talking to John while she puffed away at an e-cig. E-cigs were allowed, because although Barth Caldwell, council member and local enforcer, had kicked his nasty cigarette habit for the sake of the no-smoking law, he still needed his nicotine fix. So he'd replaced his cigarette habit with an e-cig habit and convinced Simon to allow the exception for the whole town. Head down, hands in pockets, David ducked into the alleyway behind the administration building and hurried to the back entrance. He found it open and pushed in. Hillary Moses, Simon's blonde wife, who looked a good 10 years younger than her husband, even though they were both in their early 50s, looked up from the copy machine.
"Hi, David."
"Hello, Hillary. Simon in?"
She nodded.
"Been a busy day? What do you make of it?"
"Make of what?"
She stared at him without answering.
"You mean the grid. Terrible. He's in the chambers?"
David walked toward the hall, hardly eager for a prolonged discussion with Hillary, who rarely knew when or how to stop any discourse.
"Of course the grid. What else? They say it's spreading. Texas lost half its power an hour ago. The president's holding a press conference in 20 minutes. They say he's going to declare a national state of emergency. It'll be the first time since 9/11.
She paused, then wagged her head at the hall.
"He's in with Linda."
"Thank you."
David hurried down the hall before she could speak again.
Texas.
The revelation only increased his urgency. Under any other circumstances, he might be glued to the television as well. But today, terrorist attacks on the national power grid would have to wait. 3 raps on the door returned Simon's familiar low voice.
"Come in."
David stepped in and shut the door behind him. The large council room consisted of the judge's mahogany desk at one end and a conference table in the center surrounded by 8 stuffed chairs. Cherrywood bookcases lined 3 of the walls, over 1,000 books, each one with a story that Simon would gladly tell to anyone who asked. Half of them were collector's editions. The judge sat behind his desk, feet propped up on the surface, idly tapping his cheek with a pencil. A younger twin of Clint Eastwood with a full beard, his brown eyes were inviting.
"Good morning, doctor. What's the good word?"
David looked at Linda Loving, seated in one of the 2 high-backed leather chairs facing the desk. As the director of social well-being, Linda was responsible for all matters related to community interaction and health, which included the hospital. She was the youngest of the 4 council members and the only woman. Maybe 45, though David didn't track ages or birthdays closely. Linda had blonde hair and a thin frame, 2 children. Her husband, Evan, had fallen from their roof and landed on his head 3 years earlier. She hadn't remarried. The only single parent in town. Her entire life revolved around her children, which was appropriate for someone in her position.
"Hello, Judge,"
Linda. He walked up to the desk and sat heavily in the chair next to her.
That bad?
Simon asked. David was about to respond when the judge dropped his legs to the floor and leaned forward, eyes bright. He stabbed the desk with his forefinger as he talked.
I'm telling you, David, every single hour we've spent preparing over these past 20 years, every dime, is going to pay off for us in the coming days, weeks, and months. How many times have I stood before the people and spoken the truth? Perilous times are coming, but our God will shelter us in times of trouble. Run for the hills, store up thy bounty. Some may say that our laws are harsh, but those same souls will find out just how lawlessness ends.
He leaned back, satisfied, not reveling in the destruction of others, but at peace with his provision of security for his people.
How many times, David?
Many. Linda was smiling, a gentle and loving devotee. Simon nodded.
Well, now it's time to reap what we have sown, and that, my friend, is good news for Eden.
That bad, huh?
David echoed.
The world will never be the same.
Hillary knocked once on the door and walked in, mug of steaming coffee in her hand. She crossed to her husband, set the cup down, and kissed the top of his head.
2 sugars, honey.
Thank you, darling.
He took her hand and returned a kiss to the back of her knuckles. They'd always been like this. He, the gentle master, she, the woman, all too pleased to follow his lead and return love in every way she could. Rather sexist, David thought, but par for the course in Eden. At least their love was genuine. Hillary slipped out, and Simon continued.
Whoever's behind these grid failures is no slouch. They aren't saying half of it in the media. Everything's much worse. Anyone with half a brain who spent even an hour researching the vulnerabilities of our grid knows that.
He let the comment sit, creating as good an opportunity as any.
We have a problem, David said.
They do, but...
I'm talking about Rochelle.
Simon sat back and crossed one leg over the other.
The delivery came through as promised, which, I might add, is a good thing. We are closing the road this afternoon, assuming the council approves, which it will.
He glanced at the clock on the wall.
We meet at noon. Half an hour.
You're talking about CRISPR? Linda asked.
Simon nodded. To David.
So what's the problem? When are you going to administer it?
That's just it. We already did.
Simon's brow arched.
That was quick. And?
And.
He hadn't planned to tell them everything, but it occurred to him now that he both wanted and needed their full support. Both were trustworthy and had good hearts, which was much more than he could say for the other 2 council members, Barth and Maxwell. So he told them. Everything except for Vlad Smith's claim of authority over Simon and his claim that something was very wrong in Eden. A shadow fell over Simon's expression.
What was his point? You're saying he physically attacked you?
Pushed me. I'm not sure what his point was. For all I know, he's just some nutcase who found his way in. Says he wants to bring sight to the blind. But he's not the issue. Rochelle is.
The second hand on the wall clock clicked through time.
Sight to the blind,
Simon said.
Those were his words?
Something like that.
Vlad Smith, you say. I'll let Barth know.
He jotted down the name.
The last thing we need is an intruder. So how did our brave girl do?
There was no graceful way to say it. Not good. She fell into a coma. The judge stared at him.
What do you mean? She fell into a coma?
I mean she had a reaction of some kind.
To what this Smith did?
We have no idea what's happening. We reached out to Dr. Bouchard in Paris and verified the genetic coding.
So it's not CRISPR, then?
If it is, it's a first. Either way, we have to deal with the coma now.
A beat.
I think I need to take her to Salt Lake City. Today. I just need you to know that. We've exhausted our resources here.
Simon remained silent, eyes fixed on David.
But she's safe?
Linda asked.
No, Linda. She's in a coma.
I know. I didn't mean... Forgive me, David. I don't mean to understate the seriousness of her situation. If we were talking about one of mine, I'd be climbing the walls.
She turned to Simon.
I think taking her to Salt Lake is a perfectly reasonable course of action.
It's not that simple, the judge said. Our bylaws strictly prohibit it. Not to mention we're in a state of emergency here.
My daughter's in a state of emergency, David bit off. The situation is quite simple.
No, it's not.
Denver's next to go down, and that's if we're lucky. More likely, the power collapse is going to reach the West Coast sooner than anyone expects. When that happens, Salt Lake will be affected. Even if we made an exception, you might find Salt Lake without power.
That's a risk I'm willing to take. Hospitals have generators.
Not if the attack's an EMP.
Like I said, I'll accept that risk.
The judge studied him, frowning.
I came because I respect and honor you and this valley, David said. But if I don't see a change in Rochelle in the next 2 hours, I'll have no choice but to take her.
Everyone has a choice, the judge said. You realize that if you do leave, you won't be able to return. I, for one, find Rochelle a blessing, and you're an indispensable member of our community. But I can't just bend the rules for the sake of one.
Heat flashed up David's neck, but he checked himself.
Please, Simon, doesn't Eden exist for our children?
It does, Linda said, eyeing Simon. It most certainly does. And with our restrictions on childbirth, each child is our highest priority. Rochelle may be blind, but she's more able-minded than any of her peers. I, for one, would support David's case for Salt Lake.
She was referring to a law that restricted the population of children under the age of 16, never to exceed more than 20% of the general population. With such limited space, the growth of the community had to be engineered and contained. In any case, no more than 2 children were allowed for even the most loyal and God-fearing families.
Simon dipped his head.
Give us a few minutes, will you, David? I need a word with Linda.
Now?
He indicated the door.
Have a cup of coffee with Hillary. She likes talking to you.
I don't need to stress how critical...
Just a few minutes, David. Please.
David hesitated, then stood.
Of course.
Chapter 5. The thought that I was lying on an examination table in Eden, Utah, didn't even occur to me as I ran. Neither did the fact that I could see with stunning clarity for the first time in my life. Wherever I was, it was real, more real than any dream I'd ever had, and I could hear the thunder of hooves behind me. I kept my fists pumping and my feet churning. All I could think of was that narrow 20-foot-wide canyon directly ahead of me, jerking up and down in my view as I sprinted. If I could just reach it. They could only follow me 2 or 3 at a time. That would slow them down. That's all I cared about. Never mind that I might be trapped inside. I nearly made it to the gap when I saw a smaller opening to my right. How deep? No idea. But it was only wide enough for one horse, so I altered my course without breaking stride. Someone with a deep, gruff voice was yelling,
"Mako, to the back! See if there's a way out!"
And then I was there, through the narrow gap,
sandwiched by vertical walls. The passage was maybe 5 feet wide, but it quickly opened up to twice that. Only then did it occur to me that I was in a fishbowl. If the bend ahead didn't offer me options, they would catch me right here. None of this slowed me down. I rounded the bend in 3 breaths and saw that the canyon split into 3 smaller channels. I could hear the first horse snorting as it entered the gap behind me, but I was out of sight for the moment. I had to keep it that way. I angled for the break to my left because my move would be hidden from their view for a few strides more. Of course, it didn't matter where I went because my feet were leaving marks in the sand, deep enough for even a blind person to follow. My only hope was to find an opening that was too narrow for not only their horses, but them as well. I was skinny. They were hulking warriors. A hoot and holler chased me. "No way out, albino." The canyon I found myself in was as wide as the one behind, but it too had several fissures. How deep did they go? What if these canyons ran only for a few hundred yards, like a giant rock that had been fractured over the years? They could just surround the whole thing and wait me out. I pushed the thought away, tore into the narrowest of the fissures I could quickly identify, and raced forward. Right into a huge sandy bowl, surrounded on all sides by sheer rising rock. I slid to a stop, panting, frantically searching the walls and boulders for an escape, a place to hide, any option at all. They were still coming. I could hear them talking in low tones, but they'd slowed their horses to a walk. They clearly knew something I didn't. One way or the other, they'd soon catch their prey. If there was an exit or a place to hide in the bowl, I couldn't see it. Maybe I was supposed to encounter them as a way of facing my fear, or maybe I was just in another nightmare. A horizontal crack along the bottom of the wall to my left caught my eye. It was only 10 feet away, and I reached it in 3 leaping strides. I threw myself to the sand and rolled under the cliff wall just as the first horse stepped into the opening. A low chuckle. "She hides under the wall like a mouse." The gap was only 1 foot high, and I scooted deeper on my back, then deeper, into the darkness. I stilled my breathing as best I could. To my left, blackness that could very well end in a few feet. Above me, a flat stone ceiling, inches from my nose. To my right, the thin gap under the cliff, glowing with light 20 feet away. I could see the hooves of several horses in that gap. Then boots, as one of the warriors dropped from his mount with a soft thud. He settled to 1 knee. Bent over and peered in, staring directly at me. The man was mostly backlit, but the light revealed the side of his face when he turned. His skin was cracked, dark gray. If I was an albino mystic, they were anything but. So then these riders were what Gabil had called the Horde. The warrior sniffed the air, then spat to one side and stood. I watched wide-eyed as 4 or 5 horses grouped around the first.
"How deep?"
one of them asked.
"We'll need fire to see. But she can't be too deep. Her stench is strong." "Mako, strike a fire." "Yes, sire."
I closed my eyes and tried to calm my frayed nerves. A panic attack now would get me killed. Only minutes earlier I'd been stunned by new sight. But what good was that sight now? "Though seeing, you do not see." But I did see. Right now I was trapped under a massive slab of granite. Or was I in Eden, lying on an examination table with CRISPR flowing through my veins?
"Okay, calm down, Rochelle. Take a deep breath. Think."
My senses were far more acute than most humans. Case in point, I already knew some things about the warriors that others would not. Their leader was probably the one who'd asked how deep. The authority in his voice compared to the others said so. There were 15 or 20 of them in the bowl now. I could tell by the sound of hooves, the creaking of their saddles, the small talk and coughs. And in the